Good morning. It is the first day of spring and welcome to this week's Breezy Breakfast. It is the third year of the COVID pandemic and everywhere you go, people are asking, what is the state of our healthcare? At a time when we try to think globally and act locally, this is an important ethical and practical concern. Today we hear from two people working in healthcare. Ross Curcano is the Executive Director of the Guelph Family Health Team. He oversees many practical concerns that affect both patients and healthcare professionals. Ashley Fox is a registered practical nurse who has experience in working in community and home health care, retirement and long-term care, addiction and mental health care, palliative care, and various hospital settings. Now over to our moderator, Phil.
Good morning, and welcome to this week's Breezy Breakfast. Before we begin, I would like to acknowledge that Guelph is situated on the ancestral homelands of the Anishinaabeg peoples, specifically the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation. I would further like to recognize that Canada continues to address past injustices to First Nations, including the abuse and death of many children who resided in and attended residential schools. A land acknowledgement must be a growing living recognition that truth and reconciliation will continue to be a dynamic process in which many past indignities are discovered, addressed, and ultimately for which many Indigenous people must be compensated. This month marks the third anniversary of the World Health Organization declaring the novel coronavirus COVID-19 a global pandemic. This leads to a very important question for us. What is the state of our healthcare system in Guelph? We have all heard about frontline workers in the healthcare system, the nurses, personal support workers, doctors reaching burnout. We know new residents in Guelph have a very difficult time finding a family physician. This week, we hear from people working in the healthcare field and have a discussion about where we are as they offer their perspectives. Today, we are joined by Ross Curcano, Executive Director of the Guelph Family Health Team, and Ashley Fox, a registered practical nurse. By way of introduction, a little bit about each of our guests. Ross Curcano was educated at McMaster University. Ross is the Executive Director of the Guelph Family Health Team. Under Mr. McConnell's leadership, the Guelph Family Health Team has expanded to include almost all primary care physicians in the city. The GFHT acts as a hub of the system for patients. Ashley Fox is a registered practical nurse. For those of you unfamiliar with the difference between RNs and RPNs, here is how an RPN's workday is described. Registered practical nurses are college-taught professionals who use their skill, education, and their common sense to assist patients with general or straightforward health conditions. Ashley has experience in nursing and supervisory management in the healthcare field, having worked in community and home care, retirement and long-term care, addiction and mental health systems, palliative care settings, as well as various hospital roles. Welcome to all of you. Before we hear from you, however, I'd like to express a personal view. I would have to say that healthcare is at an urgent turning point in Canada. Some might say it is in a crisis, and I'm not sure that they are not correct. Provinces are demanding more money. Burnout amongst healthcare professionals is at an all-time high. Shortages of doctors, nurses, and other healthcare professionals is almost as pandemic as COVID. We don't just hear about this in Canada, however, but we notice it throughout the world. In places like England, where healthcare has been something that has been of primacy amongst the English, and we don't seem to be able to solve it. In Canada, we tend to raid other jurisdictions rather than train more skilled workers. Ironically, at the same time, we don't accept doctors trained in places like Cuba and elsewhere, who are denied the opportunity to sit exams, assume residencies, and thereby take a place in our understaffed healthcare system. With that, I'd love to hear from you all, and I think I'd like to start with Ross, and hopefully hear from you what you can offer as observations and hopefully hope on what I just depicted as perhaps a bleak future for the medical profession. So with that, Ross, I'd love to turn it over to you for a quick introduction, and then we will move through our guests. Ross.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Phil. It's pretty hard to kind of offer a ray of sunshine after what you just said, but let me start with, I mean, there's so many factors here at play, and I will just add that I also was educated at Guelph. That's where I did my master's, so a long time in Guelph. And the reason I'm saying that is because back when I was in school, we talked about the human resource shortage that was going to happen in the 2020s. And we said the baby boom's going to age and we're going to be short of workers. And guess what? It's the 2020s and we are. For sure, you talked about shortages and burnout and all of those things in the medical and healthcare professions. And I certainly, there's lots to talk about there. But I'd say ask someone who owns a restaurant, you know, talk to Bernie from Bungusto, or talk to someone from retail, or talk to Linda Hasenfratz at Linamar. Human resource shortages are endemic, I think, across probably most of the world, but certainly here in Ontario and in Canada, we knew this was coming. So we have to do things differently because of the population pyramid that we're experiencing right now. Pandemic has thrown all of it for a loop. So there's a whole lot more to talk about related to the pandemic, but we shouldn't be surprised. I think what happened is the world stopped turning a little bit for a couple of years during the pandemic. And then we opened our eyes and said, wow, look at the situation we're in. And so I think there's a lot more going on than just a crisis in the healthcare system, but the healthcare system crisis is certainly impacted by what's going on.
Thank you very much, Ross. And with that, perhaps we could hear from Ashley. Ashley, welcome to Breezy Breakfast. Your job in the trenches and on the front lines is truly appreciated. And I'm sure that you can provide us with some experiences that that will enlighten us today. Welcome.
Thank you very much. And thank you for your kind words. I have been a home care nurse for approximately 12 years. And one of the things that's unique about my setting is that I work in the urban community of Kitchener-Waterloo, but I live in northern Wellington. So I live in Minto or Palmerston, Harrison, Clifford area. And I'm going to echo what Ross said about the pandemic throwing things for a loop. We had systemic issues in the rural communities that really exasperated, not just from the pandemic, but what we were seeing for internal pressures and external pressures. As wait times increased in the cities, people were actually going to rural emerges and rural communities seeking to speed up their access to care. These communities rely on family physicians who actually work in our emergency departments and assist with them. And they were overwhelmed by, unfortunately, the people that were looking for access. One of the things that we hope to see a little bit differently, you've mentioned burnout, how that impacts physicians and nurses. It impacts the whole sector. We're seeing actually that lab techs are in demand right now, in huge demand, occupational therapists, physiotherapists, and we don't see them in the news. We're often talking about nurses all the time or physicians, but we need to realize it's a full sector issue. I have been on parental leave since August, so I've navigated this as a nurse for my patients, but also as a patient. And I can tell you as a new mom, it was incredibly stressful navigating medical care for my daughter. The rural emergency department was fantastic. She was 6 days old and we thought she had had a seizure. We waited in the emergency department for a few hours, not for the emergency doctor, but for a doctor to see us and admit us in Guelph, London, or McMaster. And each time the emergency doctor had to advocate for us saying, please, you know, she's a 6 day baby, she needs to be seen. And that was the holdup was, accessing care in external communities when we're having systemic issues, it's quite an issue right now, not just the burnout.
Thank you very much. I've got a couple of questions, and I noticed that in the chat, Susan Rosenthal raised a couple of important issues. And I'm actually going to see whether Susan would be willing to talk a little bit. She made some mention of the fact that perhaps it's not hopeless, but there are challenges. Susan, are you willing to elaborate on the notion that it's discouraging, but not hopeless?
Yeah. If we face the situation as it actually is and not as we wish it would be, it is. It's very discouraging. We have basically lost. And I think one of the Ontario Health Coalition sessions I was at that Natalie was speaking at, I mean, she was started off basically in tears, admitted. She says, you know, we failed. We have, we've lost it. And there's no point in beating around the bush and thinking this is going to be any kind of easy turnaround. We didn't have to lose it. This was completely preventable. You know, like Dr. Kirkconnell said, I graduated in 1974 from medical school. And at that time, it was almost peak, around the time of peak funding, we started to see the cuts then. And it's been going on for decades and decades, and it's been allowed. We've allowed it to happen by not fighting back, primarily not fighting back through unions. You know, the defeat of the Ontario Hospital Workers' Strike in 1981 did not have to happen. And it was one of the first major protests against the cuts to staff, the cuts to standards. And that was lost. It didn't have to be. We could have had at that time a major public sector fight back against the whole austerity agenda. But in that case, CUPE did, you know, back down, the OFL back down. And this has been the pattern, in the same we see with the nurses today. You know, instead of challenging Bill 124 with a strike, an all-out public sector strike, there's too much willingness to go along with the enemy's rules. I mean, who wins a battle if you play by the enemy's rules? You're not going to win. And we have lost and lost and lost. I am totally for unions. I'm very much a pro-trade union. The problem is not unions per se. The problem is that the union officials, the whole institution of unions, is tied now into the state, is part of the labor management system of capitalism. And they are not willing to challenge the government, seriously challenge it. They'll drop the phrase general strike here and there, but it's not every time that there's been a chance to actually build one, they back down. Because what's going to happen if we have a general strike that says we don't accept these policies, we do not want to work in a province that does not offer people comprehensive and quality health care, we do not want to work in a system that doesn't take care of its workers, then what does that mean? Who will rule, right? Okay. And right now there is nobody, no party saying we're going to reverse this, we're going to go full on invest in public health care. You know, that's what people want. All the polls show Canadians want investment in public services. They don't want cuts to health care. They don't want cuts to education or anything else, right? But that is a moral force, and that doesn't carry weight with the people who are making decisions.
Great. Thank you very much. Ross, let's hear from you on that. What I'm hearing from Susan was that what we have is a historical failure of the healthcare system. And I'm wondering whether what we have right now is the possibility of change, of doing things differently. I'm concerned about the Canada Health Act, and I'll come back to that in a bit. I think the Canada Health Act, established in the 1960s, has been changed very little, and there might be some fundamental problem there. Ross, what are your views from the perspective of administration?
Yeah, there's so many issues here. You know, I agree with you that labor's played a role, Susan, but I think that it's bigger than that. I think it relates to immigration. It relates to social welfare at a great living wage. All of those issues have really come into play. You know, one of the things that I often think about is our short attention spans. And I think about the start of the pandemic when people were clanging the pots and such on behalf of the healthcare workers and nurses and doctors and lab techs and others. And, you know, and then the tables turned. And, you know, I mean, that seemed like such a landmark moment. But it was a really short moment in time. And I see the full page ads in the Globe and Mail on the weekend, you know, from the nursing union asking about Bill 124 and challenging the government on Bill 124. But, you know, I think our attention spans are short. It's Bill 124 today. It's something else tomorrow. So to your question, Phil, you know, I think we are in a bit of a crisis spot, and I think we have to do things differently. There's some things that we've done that maybe I'll be a bit controversial about, but I think it's okay. I think the government was wise to really make a thoughtful decision on hospital sizing, you know, back in the 80s, 90s, I don't know, pick your decade. You know, I think The unfortunate thing is when you save money from downsizing hospitals, you need to reinvest in community and home care, in long-term care, in primary care, and the related changes didn't happen. So listening to all the stuff that's going on between the feds and the provinces around healthcare investment, it is responding to the Canadian priority around a healthcare system. What we need to see happen is actually delivery on some of those things. We need to see significant reinvestment in primary care. We need to see significant reinvestment in home care. Locally, to just kind of play that out a little bit, locally through the Ontario Health Team planning we're doing, we're saying, you know, I mean, there's a jargon term, the patient medical home. What we're calling it locally is the patient's care team. And start with your doctor and their team and build out from there. And so big assumption, everyone has a family doctor or a primary care provider, a doctor, a nurse practitioner, a primary care team. That's where we need to start and then build out from there and then make our silos more connected. And I think we do have an opportunity to do that. And I know Ashley's done some work in home care. And I can tell you from a family doctor perspective, you have a patient that might need some home care. You find out that they're getting home care. You might not know why exactly or what they're doing. And similarly, the nurse, the physiotherapist or whomever going into the home might not know what the doctor's thinking. And you're relying on a broken chain of communications. So I think we do have some opportunity. I think it's around investment. I think it's investment in technology. And I think it's investment in workers in the system to knit those things together. I think the potential's there, but it's going to take a lot of goodwill on behalf of government, and it's going to take some change in expectations among doctors, nurses, administrators, and others in the system.
Okay, thanks. Before I pass it over to some of the questions that have come in and to some of the individuals, I just want to follow up on that a little bit. I don't know whether anybody has comments. What struck me about the Canada Health Act was it was essentially founded in approximately 1965, and there have been no significant reforms because of some constitutional and some other challenges. And I look at the audience, no disrespect to anybody that's here, including me, but we were the baby boom at the time that the Canada Health Act was established. And now we're the baby boomers nearly gone. And our healthcare needs have changed substantially. And my question has been for many years is, why have we not reformed the Canada Health Act so that we are considering many new forms of medicine that were not available at that point, many new drugs that were not available? And is it just a money issue, or is there something that's inherently stubborn about Canadians that we just like to stick to it and we're not going to change things until the crisis happens? Ross, any comments on that?
Wow, that's a good one. I mean, I think we all hold dear to our heart as Canadians, the Canada Health Act and as a foundational document for, you know, what's really important to us. But I agree with you. I think that it was written at a moment in time, like so many pieces of legislation or guiding practices were written at a moment in time, and the world has changed fundamentally. You know, I think, you know, we've all heard of the, even just more recently with the pandemic and the impact of virtual care, that wasn't even a possibility at the time of the writing of the Canada Health Act. Never mind, you know, the ability to take a picture of a rash and send it to your doctor who can send it to a dermatologist to get a response, you know, relatively quickly. So I think we have to look at, you know, what are the principles of the act, and then operationalize those principles. I think it's like any legislation. Legislation can't take into consideration all the variations. And that's why we have policies. And I think we need a hard look at what are the important principles in the Canada Health Act and how are we operationalizing them and where are we challenging them? Where are we actually at the margins of really challenging the principles in the Canada Health Act? Because I think some of that discussion is going on now.
And I think we will have a couple of challenges coming up in the conversation. Ashley, you've been quiet because I haven't asked you a question yet, but you're on the front lines and you're also uniquely positioned to offer me an education on something I don't know much about, and that's rural healthcare. What are your observations on the challenges that we are currently facing, not just within the cities, but throughout rural Ontario as well?
Thank you. One of the biggest issues, and Ross kind of hit it on the head there, is the lack of primary care physicians. Urban centers are very lucky, although there are shortages in urban settings. And when we look at the day-to-day work of a primary care team in rural Ontario, it's much more than just opening your clinic. It's much more than just seeing patients and documentation in that sense. In Northern Wellington right now, there is a wait list for a family physician that's almost reaching 3,000. That's a lot of people without a doctor. And things that we take for granted, so access to disability forms, return to work forms, things of that nature, a lot of people are actually resorting to calling eMERGE, and that's not their role. That's not something they can help with. So we're leaving people that are falling between the cracks, essentially, because where do they access their care, and how do they access their care?
What I'm hearing you say, and maybe both you and Ross might have a comment, is that the emergency room has become the de facto family physician. And from what I understand, that's a serious problem. I was wondering if either of you could highlight some of what has been the challenge with that.
There's so many problems with that. I mean, first of all, I guess at the root of it is, what is the role of the primary care provider, the nurse practitioner, the family doctor? And you know, I think of them, and Ashley, your story with your little one is a good example. I think of them as the rock, you know, and, you know, there are lots of times in our lives we don't seem to need them, but we know they're there, and we know they're there when we need them. And, you know, so if I'm going through, you know, I might be a 17-year-old guy that doesn't need to see the family doctor ever, but then something happens. I have a first episode psychosis at 25, and all of a sudden I know my family doctor. Or I'm the new mom, and I'm bringing my baby in for well baby visits, you know, on a regular basis. And I'm counting on the family doctor to kind of look at me, look at my baby, and just, yes, do what's needed, but also to be there and just make sure we're holding up. And, you know, I think of the work that nurse practitioners do with families and really solid primary care in our system. We have great people who are a rock. And it's funny when we ask ourselves as, I don't know, as people, as Canadians, what is the role of our family doctor? I think we think about them being there and that relationship being important. And so when you talk about an emergency room for care, yeah, it's transactional. They can sew up a wound, but they're not looking at why the wound happened and the conditions why the wound happened and my stress in my life and my not being able to make ends meet and those sorts of things. And I think even as our systems are even pressured more and more, I think the ability for nurse practitioners and doctors to be able to even do some of that stuff is more challenged. So It's the centrality of that relationship and the ability of that relationship to really flourish, I think, is really under stress right now.
Ashley, do you want to add anything to that one?
No, I just wanted to emphasize and agree in the sense that the family doctor, their role is the center of the chain. So they are the access for often referrals, diagnostic tests. They're the first person I contact in home care if I have any questions or need an order change. We've often been beating on pots for nurses and hospitals and things of that nature. We really just need to recognize the importance of our family doctors.
Okay. You know, Ross, you brought something up that just reminded me of my dad. You talked about the emergency room and stitching people up. My father tended to treat healthcare like I would treat an automobile mechanic, that he would go to the doctor to get something fixed or a new piece put in, and that's not an exaggeration. I'm talking about heart bypasses and so on and so forth. I'm wondering how much of this, the onus is on the the community, the residents of Ontario, and the issue of healthy lifestyle versus believing that the medical system can fix whatever ails us, whether it's a mother's little helper that's needed or whether it's a new heart that's needed. Are we really, in some senses, stressing it by our expectations?
Oh, for sure. You know, what a great point. And we're living in a really funny time. You know, a word that bothers me that I use, but I hear it and I see it in social media is entitled. And the whole entitlement thing kind of bothers me because it doesn't speak to our own role in a healthy social system. And, you know, I know when I have that, I'll say second glass of wine, that is probably not good for my system. And so what accountability am I taking for that? I know when, you know, I think we all know we should try and, I think, everything in moderation, but eat healthy, be as active, be social, get sleep, moderate consumption, all of those sorts of things. We have to play a role. Our health is not looked after by the health system. Our health is looked after by ourselves. Our health is supported by the health system. And, you know, I think we need to, this is nothing new, but we need to take a hard look at what our role is. And then when we think about the role with the family doctor or others in the health system, we think about that as a partnership, not as a customer client relationship, but actually a partnership.
I would agree. The other emphasis I want to add to it as well is while health is looked after by ourselves, you know, when the pandemic and emergency closures or just being told not to go to the emergency unless it was needed. As a nurse, when talking to patients on the front line, I can't stress the number of times that people have told me I don't need to go to emerge or I don't want to bother them. They're busy. So when we look at those messages that we're conveying to patients, we're actually conveying a greater risk to them, especially for some that, you know, are having signs of a cardiac condition or signs of a stroke that we know they're not going to be able to see their family physician if they have one. So health is looked after by ourselves, but we can do a better job of streamlining that messaging as well.
Can I just add one thing? And I see Britt's hand up. And I would say that also we have to, you know, going back to principles of Canadian society, let's not be arrogant or elitist about this either. There are people in our system who need help, for whom looking after yourself isn't as easy. And isn't that one of the principles of Canadian society? And one of the things we're proud about as Canadians is that we look after folks who need it, whether it's housing, whether it's employment, or whether it's addictions or healthcare. So when I talk about our own role in our healthcare, I'm very mindful of the fact that due to conditions beyond our control, there are times when we just can't and we need some help. I think that needs to be, we need to be proud of that as Canadians and build that into our system.
I want to make a comment. I was recently listening to a podcast by the Canadian Medical Association Journal, and a lot of this isn't because there's a lack of physicians. It's because physicians are not seeing patients on time. So their cases are becoming more complex. They're spending more time with each individual patient. Doctors don't necessarily want to spend more time with patients because they can only bill for a certain amount of views or visits. And so they're seeing more people with worsening conditions. I think it's a really dangerous and slippery slope to start putting the blame on patients and saying it's all our active lifestyle. Obviously, I think most people are aware of this. You start putting blame on people whether they deserve an illness or they don't. I, for one, have multiple chronic illnesses that I've had since I was 2. And so I need to see a physician every so often. And if I'm not able to see that physician, there's a very good possibility that my condition will worsen. So getting people the access to care on a timely manner, it's changing the system so that individuals have the ability to see a doctor. I don't know whether it's like community care based so that they can see the same physician in their areas based on population, but I don't think we should just be neglecting this and putting the blame on patients.
Absolutely. And thank you very much for raising that issue, Brett. I think that's very important. The issue of victimizing victim is one that I think is problematic within our culture. And I think that we need to clearly identify that that's not an intent ever, that the real challenge is encouraging people to recognize the role that they have in good health, which is, I think, a slightly significant difference. And I appreciate your comments on let's not victimize a victim. There are many people that need good health care now and, in fact, needed it yesterday, and it's not there. And thank you very much for that.
We need to value the work that physicians do. I'm aware that I'm not a physician. I don't have that training. Therefore, when I do have an issue, I'm going to rely on someone who has the training and the responsibility to help me out. And I think now we're seeing people going to pharmacists for different ailments. You don't go to your mechanic when you need to go to a doctor. Like, you go to the person you need to go to see. So valuing the work that doctors do, I don't know, I think that just should be the primary focus. I didn't necessarily mean that patients aren't victims, but I can see how it led that way.
No. The nice thing about this discussion is it's open-ended, and sometimes we can really get into heated disagreements, which I think is what discourse should always be.
And Phil, if I could, on that comment, I mean, one of the things that drew me, you know, I worked in Guelph a long time. I started up the CCAC when I was here first and chose to leave that sector to start up the family health team. The reason being, it wasn't because there was a pay increase, because there wasn't. It was a pay cut. But it was because I believed in, you know, the capacity for what we can and should be doing. And speaking to a bit of Britt's comments, the idea of real team-based care made a lot of sense to me. That, you know, if I'm struggling with diabetes and I just can't keep my blood sugars in control, my physician, like the carpenter, has a range of tools. The dietitian has some other tools. The nurse has some other tools. And, you know, so I think we need to think about family doctors and primary care differently. And, you know, the notion of team-based care in Ontario, they, you know, said, let's set up family health teams, you know, back in, 2007, six or seven. And they did it for 30% of the province. And 70%, they said, well, that seems like a great idea, but we're out of money. You know, back to your question about when the Canada Health Act was written, you know, one in eight Canadians didn't have diabetes. One in five, mental health at any point in time wasn't, whether it was there and not articulated, our obesity epidemic, pick your disease, it doesn't matter. And, you know, the dementia pandemic that's about to hit us as a society. So absolutely respect the role of the physician in the team, but respect the team that we as patients need some more options for how our care can be delivered. I might need to, I'm a new mom, I might need a 35 or 40 minute visit. And maybe the NP is a better choice for me right now, because that's really going to help me cope with my baby crying all night long. And so I think we have a bit of an opportunity with the direction that we've stuck our toes in the water in team-based primary care to build on that as a core element of the system.
And I think that there's much about the team-based that's very valuable. To give you a good example, my daughter's a midwife in Toronto at North York General Hospital. And she just changed her job. She was a midwife in the traditional sense, the Ontario traditional sense, where she was on call 24 hours a day. She found that that was burning her out. The North York Hospital has offered an innovative program where she's providing postpartum care that OBGs are not providing at the North York Hospital. She's working 8 hours, and hopefully as part of this experimental program, this will be something that will come to other areas of Ontario, which will, again, enhance elements of the team system that weren't even envisioned in 1965, let alone was she as a modern midwife envisioned at that point as well. We have a few questions. I want to try to get to Gord, because Gord, you raised something earlier and you piqued my interest. You mentioned the Grove system. And I'm wondering if you could ask the question and maybe fill us in on what you mean by the Grove system or whatever it was that you had raised.
I'm a member of the local Y, and they are one of the Grove hubs, which I just learned recently. And I don't know much about it, except it's attempting to deal with the mental health issues of youth. I think it's 12 to 21 or 25 or something like that. How it actually works, what it does, I don't know much about it, but it's something that there's funding for, and the Guelph Y is expanding its facilities and their fundraising, and that's where I heard about it. So I'm sure Ross has probably been in the middle of some of this stuff.
Ross, what can you tell us about the Grove system?
Yeah, it's the youth wellness hubs, and it's a great notion around, you know, the topics that you probably chat about before the meeting starts, about how we, you know, have Facebook or TikTok friends rather than real friends. And, you know, we have this unfortunate clash of cultures right now, and again, exacerbated by the pandemic. Our youth mental health is really, we're seeing it front and center. And so the old notions, again, you know, Phil, your comment about when the Canada Health Act was written, the role of churches and community centers when that was written was very different than it is today. You know, as schools try and build in as much curriculum as they're mandated to do, some of the social side of school falls off. So what we're seeing is the impact of kids struggling. And the idea that there could be a place where kids can get together, supporting their mental health with certainly formal supports available, but it's the informal stuff, making it available. I've always said, you know, I've been a longtime member of the Y too, but I've always said that social prosperity comes in not so much in what's happening in the classroom, but it's the kids, you know, shooting some hoops after school or I'm trying to think of a non-sports example. Doesn't matter. Anything. Cubs and Scouts. You know, look at the erosion of scouting. Look at the erosion of so many of these things. So we're trying some new solutions that really have at their base an understanding of what some of the problems are, but multiple approaches to make it appealing to kids. And I think that's a really important thing. You know, I don't want to liken it to, but there are some similarities. You know, back in the whenever 80s, we invested in senior centers because we said we had isolated seniors. And just walk into Evergreen and want, you know, or look at the waiting list for people wanting to play pickleball. You know, it's important. And we have an isolated society. So having some places, some other solutions to replace previous solutions that no longer carry the weight that they used to, how can that be bad? And I think we have to try some things out. And if it works for 10 or 15 years and then it stops working and we try something else, I think that's okay too.
The Guelph Family Health Team highlights that most primary care physicians in Guelph are part of the Guelph Family Health Team, meaning the patients are rostered through OHIP to a specific physician. On the website for the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, it states in part that, quote, prior to ending the physician-patient relationship, physicians must be, bear in mind that ending the relationship may have significant consequences for the patient, for example, by limiting their access to care. In my experience as a medical office assistant, my understanding of changing doctors for whatever reason is that one may not de-roster from one physician to another within the same health team. One Guelph clinic I worked in saw many individuals who had their physician-patient relationship severed and were unaware of this rule. How does the fact that almost every single doctor in the city is under the same health team work when an individual is dissatisfied with their physician or becomes non-compliant in some fashion and are fired by their primary care provider?
Wow. How much time do we have? that's, and it would work the same in the rural communities. Minto Mapleton Family Health Team, the Mount Forest Family Health Team, the Upper Grand Family Health Team, the East Wellington Family Health Team. And we're lucky in Guelph and Wellington that most people are covered by family health teams. Less lucky that we need more resources to deal with people without a physician. So that's my preamble. So two issues there I'd like to speak to. One is when the primary care provider leaves, and the second when a patient is fired by the doctor. I'll use the crass word. When the physician leaves, we don't want it to be a scramble. So part of my role that I've taken on is to work with physicians that are planning to leave to try and find a replacement. And of course, that's a tricky thing in this world, but certainly this province at this time. But I would say over the last 3 years, just to illustrate, here in Guelph, we've brought in 17 new family doctors. 10 of them have replaced retiring doctors. So 7 new, 10 retirements. So we do, you know, our best to try and recruit a replacement. And I got to tell you, you know, it's slim pickings. It's tough because every community is trying to, if we recruit a doctor, that means Fergus didn't, or that means Kingston didn't, and vice versa. So when a physician leaves, we hope we know soon enough that we can do our best, get someone in and try and support. So that's that side of it. I will say, I don't know if it's easier, let's just say different. When a physician terminates the relationship with a patient, I'm seldom involved in that, and I'm probably grateful for that. And it's really the relationship between the patient and physician. So I'm not really privy to that relationship. And there has to be, as you've talked about in the words, a decision that this is a broken relationship. It's kind of like a divorce, I guess. And where we can, and again, as a community here, I can speak to Guelph, we work to try and get that patient a new physician in the same way we would with someone moving to Guelph, in the same way we would with a new immigrant, to try and get them. Essentially, the term orphan patient, essentially they're now an orphan patient. And the province has a system called Healthcare Connect. It has, I think, some success, but I wouldn't say it's fixed the problem. It's basically a central repository where patients can apply and doctors can pull, you know, files from. But it's tough when someone needs a doctor right now. It's really tough. And as Ashley talked about in rural Wellington, where family physicians do family practice, but also do community clinics and also do hospital, it's even shorter than here. And in, I don't know, Elliott Lake, it's probably worse yet. So I don't have a really good answer for you, the patient-specific answer. I think it's that people try their best, but there is no real easy path. If I've been let go by my family doctor, or I've decided I can't work with my family doctor, I'm starting at square one again.
Okay, Ross, I just want to follow that up. One of the questions that was just asked was, There's an understanding, whether it's true or not, I don't know, that a fired patient cannot get a doctor in the same family health team. Is that true? Dr. Ross fires me, I cannot be picked up by, Dr. Tanya. Is that true or not?
I've never heard that. I don't believe that to be true. So I'd have to look at, well, I can tell you experientially, it's not true. So, I know that recently through my office, not that we do a lot of patient matching, but we had an experience where we were aware of a situation like that, where they were matched with another physician. So I don't believe it to be true. I think it would be clumsy if it was in the same office. So if you were on, pick a practice, Westminster Woods, it might be kind of awkward because you're fired by, you know, Dr. Britt, and then Dr. Tanya says, I'll take you, and it's the same receptionist. But I haven't seen that to be true, and I wouldn't want it to be true.
How many students are we actually admitting and graduating? And have those numbers been raised? I was going to ask you a question about foreign trained doctors, and I'll come back to that after this one. But if you've got any ideas on this, that would certainly be helpful.
They've raised the numbers a little bit in medical school and in nursing schools and in others, but I remain quite concerned when I look at the demographics of the healthcare workforce and retirements within the next 5 years. I think we need to be more aggressive about those numbers.
I just want to follow that up a little bit. And then I think I want to go to Ashley about some rural health issues as well. But it last summer, two summers ago, my wife and I hosted a fellow who had been trained offshore. He was a competent doctor. That competency was clear because he wrote the medical exams in the United States because he couldn't write them here to get his residency for the United States. Now, he worked here in a pharmacy for a while, essentially referring patients, and actually became an in-home care supporter to somebody for a while till he had to leave Guelph. But the question is, in my mind, is tragic. Here's a fellow who was Canadian educated, who went offshore to get medical training, came back, is now at Mount Sinai Hospital, I believe it's Mount Sinai, in New York City, is doing a residency there, and wants to work in Canada, but there's every likelihood that he's going to settle in the United States as a consequence of essentially getting the residency there. How do we deal with that? Because I've heard this over and over again, that foreign trained doctors just aren't welcome. And I don't want to cast a net and blame anyone, but I do get confused by this.
Yeah, I get a little confused by it too. You know, the international medical grads, basically, as I understand it, this is beyond government. This is with the regulatory colleges, but you know there are standards within the Canadian system. And Ashley, you'd know probably better as a nurse, but it applies to nursing and other professions as well. And there, you know, is a licensing exam. You know, ultimately, I suppose it's like any profession, whether it's engineers or lawyers or anything. There are the Canadian standards. And, you know, who is deemed to meet the Canadian standards and who is not. And I can't speak with a lot of knowledge about it, but I know there are many discussions going on in levels, you know, far above my pay grade around nurses, around doctors and others around how we can open the doors a little wider. It's an interesting one, right? Because you know, is a two-year medical degree in another country equivalent to a seven-year in Canada? I think it's easy to say, well, no, it can't be. But, you know, I think we shouldn't measure things by time. There has to be standards. Similarly, the other side of the coin is patients. We want to ensure that our providers, our nurses, our doctors, our physios do meet the standards of the Canadian college. That's why we have colleges. So it's a super tricky one. And the other issue, which I'll throw on the table, and you talked about it earlier when you said rating of the jurisdictions, you know, it would be great to get some more Vietnamese doctors here, but are we then passing the problem on to Vietnam? So this is a ethics 101 kind of topic as much as anything.
One of the big issues with foreign trained doctors, I ran into this with one of the doctors I worked at with a visual or a virtual clinic. So he was working as a doctor, helping the virtual doctor, but because there was no physician that was willing to take on the supervisory role that is required as part of a foreign trained doctor becoming licensed in Canada, that is where the biggest problem is. And as we've got our physicians retiring, like an older doctor isn't going to want to take on what's required in supervising a new young doctor that's been foreign trained. And the younger doctors are still trying to get their practices going so they don't feel like they have the time to supervise somebody that's foreign trained. So that disconnect there is only going to get worse.
I'm kind of curious as to the sort of when the MO of the family doctor, the GP, changed. Many of the are of the opinion that the ER and ED, whatever, are being flooded because GPs are more or less gatekeepers now and then shuffle the people out of their office as quickly as they possibly can. My own experience is that if you want to see a GP, you have to make an appointment. I go to see him. There's nobody in the waiting room. I'm waiting there for 2 minutes and they'll see me and I'm out of there again. Somewhere we've lost the plot here because GP waiting rooms should be full of people that can walk in off the street to be seen, surely. If they have to make an appointment to see one, it's a complete disincentive. They won't go and see them. They'll go to the ED instead. And something's gone wrong in that system, I think.
That's an interesting point, John. I do understand that in fact, the frustration level is sometimes high enough that a person just wants to get to where they're going to get some sort of attention. Ross, any comments on that?
Well, that's such a tough one, you know, because, you know, you're hearing all the discussion before this about scarcity of supply and using people's time. At the same time, you know, I don't want to go to see my doctor 2 weeks later and tell them, boy, I was sure sick 2 weeks ago, but I couldn't get in to see you. So, you know, and also, of course, we have the need for regular and preventative care. So it's a complex system. You know, what I think most doctors try to do, quite invisible to most patients, is fill up sort of three quarters of their day and leave a quarter of the day for same day spots. And that's pretty standard, I think. But, you know, then your day's full and then someone calls and says, you know, any chance I could get in today? We've all done it. And they, well, we'll squeeze you in, but you might have to wait for a little bit. You know, we've all been through those scenarios. I think as much as anything, it's a supply and demand issue. You know, I think the, you know, if the doctor opens their day sheet and says, hey, I've got 20 patients today, well, I can squeeze in easily five more, but can I squeeze seven? Can I squeeze nine? Can I squeeze 10? And then what does that do to the quality of care for each of the other visits? So, boy, oh boy, I think it's, you raise a question that has a complexity of discussion.
A lot of questions, a lot of answers. And I'm going to flip it over to Ashley because I do want to hear about some of the rural challenges. And a question did come in, Ashley, that I think is a really solid one. Other than the lack or the absence of physicians in rural and remote areas, what are some of the challenges that you personally experience in rural healthcare?
The biggest one that I would say secondary to hospitals and primary care is home care. We have a aging population very similar to our urban counterparts, and access to home care PSWs and nurses is quite difficult because between rural communities to meet the hours that those staff need, they're traveling between multiple communities in a day. We know that timing is of the essence, so someone very often will want morning care, but it's not necessarily the same time as someone else down the road. And we also know, which we've discussed earlier, is wage discrepancies. Our colleagues in home care make significantly less compared to our colleagues in hospital and long-term care. When my position was up for a maternity contract in Kitchener, there was a young nurse in my area who applied. It's about a 50-minute drive, so not bad. And one of the reasons she had applied is she was making under $20 an hour as a nurse. This is not it's public news now, and it has been for a few months, but if the public was more aware, I think we'd be able to advocate more for that profession, because we need home care nurses. We know what the wave that we're in right now.
So we're just not paying people enough for something as essential as healthcare is what I'm hearing you saying. Very important point. We do need the money as well as perhaps the reforms. And I do want to raise a couple of issues about my comments about the Canada Health Act. In 1965, I'm going to be glib here a bit, there was no such thing as substance abuse, and there was no such thing as mental health issues. Ashley, in rural Ontario, are you experiencing the same challenges with substance abuse that we are seeing in the more urban centers?
Absolutely, as well as mental health. Access to referrals are no different than our colleagues in the urban centers. Significant wait lists for programs that are publicly funded. Fantastic programs. We're talking like Graybers has Keystone. There's a variety of different ones in the rural communities, but we're looking at anywhere from an 8 month to an 18 month wait. And for people that are in crisis, that's significant.
And Ross, just any comments on my remarks about mental health and substance abuse today, as opposed to a long time ago in a healthcare system far, far away?
So the good news side of that story, I'll say, is we're talking about it. Finally. And I long for the day when we can openly say, I have a mental health issue, and we talk about it the same way as I have cancer or I have diabetes, without the judgment. Prevalence is, it obviously existed, you were being glib, but we're talking about it. So that's the good news. We have real problems with access, and certainly in, I'll just build on Ashley's comments, in rural Wellington County, our highest rates of suicide are adult men, non-seniors, non-adolescent. And there are a bunch of issues, and then access to resources. So we have pretty good. We have fair access to specialized mental health resources in Guelph. Much poorer in rural Wellington, and for many specialist care, in fact, much of specialist care in rural Wellington, people have to either go a distance far from their family. So now you're with your loved one and you're down in London or Toronto, or you're doing a virtual care appointment, and good, bad, and ugly, everything in between. So, I think all the problems we talk about get exacerbated when you're in a rural community. And I got to say, Ashley, you didn't say it, but from a home care nurse, my goodness, I remember when I worked in CCAC and hearing the PSW driving up a lane in Melanchthon Township to a house that didn't have electricity to do some personal care with somebody, quite different from, the PSW that goes into Woodlawn Towers. So you need to be really mindful, and I tell you, if there are heroes in the system, I would say, let's talk about rural home care workers, because they're walking into a home. They don't know what they're going to walk into necessarily, and being pressured to get in and get out to get to their next visit at the same time walking in and finding who knows what.
Yeah, and I was actually going to raise that one, and Ashley, it looked like you were going to comment on this. I'm going to ask you both, because it's a very uncomfortable issue. And that is the issue of domestic violence, and whether it's violence against seniors within the nuclear family, whatever. This was something that was not seen or not talked about 30, 40 years ago, but clearly is part of what we deal with in family medicine as well. We've talked about it with regards to police and first line interveners. What about healthcare workers? How do we address that kind of a crisis as well? Ashley, in the rural areas, it's something I'm very unfamiliar with, but I know it's real and I know it's difficult.
Absolutely. We've got two sides of it. So we've got staff that are very similar to what Ross had mentioned, not sure what they're walking in on, having risk assessments, things of that nature, especially in domestic and elder. But what we're seeing is that if they don't have the supports to support them on the front line, we often talk about frontline workers being short. back in the day when I was a home care worker in Own Sound, you know, I could call my supervisor on the live telephone and actually have a conversation in that moment. And now what we're seeing is because there's so many clients, so much time, you can't necessarily get that same one-on-one relationship with your supervisor to have those talks. And what we're also seeing as well, and I think you've kind of implied it in your questioning, is also the increased risk of violence to healthcare workers. You know, we're seeing that in hospitals, we're seeing that everywhere, to be honest, but really in Emerge, when people are waiting, we know that people are scared. We know that there's pressures in the system as well. And unfortunately, staff do take a hit on that one.
Yeah, and those are great comments. And I would add that, you know, back to John's comment about the number of people in the waiting room or not, you know, it's unfortunately what happens is someone comes in for a doctor's appointment around their, sore back. And as they're having the conversation, then they break down and say, this is going on at home. And you can't send the person out of the room when that happens. You have to open that conversation. Then that puts your whole day behind, but what are you going to do? And I think those issues for any frontline healthcare worker, those issues exist and pop up often in situations where you don't expect them. And, you know, that's the thing that I think we have to be a little bit kinder about as patients when our doctor's running late, because we don't necessarily have an ability to blame the doctor. Sometimes these things happen, and I'd gladly sit and wait if I knew that something like that was going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, and thank you. I would think that for frontline workers, such as home care workers, this would be tremendously challenging. When I was a teacher, I had a duty to report for people that are essentially, in many respects, coming off the street. I'm not even certain whether they've had the sufficient training to know what the legal responsibilities might be that are entailed if they suspect even that there is any form of violence or abuse occurring. And one of the new challenges, of course, is that violence towards seniors and elders, which I think is going to be something that we're going to need to respond to far more quickly. Having said that, Owen, who's sitting here, has been in the talk for a long time, had a comment about social workers in the hospital setting a long time ago. And I didn't even think about social workers, Owen. I was wondering if you could raise some of those concerns, because clearly you have some personal experience with.
Yeah, absolutely. My fiance / wife, she's a social worker actually at St. Joe's here in Guelph. So she's actually in the long-term care side of it, which is, it's a really interesting dynamic which is going on there, but that's a whole tangent. But right now she's working by herself for 200 and about 20 residents, which it takes about half an hour per resident per day. So if you work an 8-hour shift, how many residents do you think you can get in a day? And these are people varying from, you know, dementia cases to just needing help with like little things, just, you know, buying some clothes or just the littlest of things. And it's difficult for a lot of people getting into the medical field, especially in the young side, because it's not necessarily there's not the positions there. It's that even the public organizations aren't providing the slots required to fill into these. Like we see in the education field, you know, with the large class sizes that we had to fight against. And yet here they are again. And now it's, you know, one teacher to 30 students, or in my wife's case, it's one social worker for 200 residents. And if she needs to get to a certain amount of residents in a day, you know, how can you, you know, effectively serve 200 people if you have to go see every single one of them, if you spend about half an hour taking care of them, giving them what they need, you know, from a social aspect as well as psychological and whatever other requirements or needs, because she has to manage not just going and seeing them, but also organizing their days, organizing if they need to get clothes, new medications, stuff like that, stuff that should be delegated to other paths and careers, but isn't always working out that way, unfortunately. Do you have any specific questions? I could feel free to answer, though.
I think that we should recognize that one of the things about healthcare that's very important is that Canadians care, and that matters a lot. We have a medical system here that ensures that there is medical support available to everyone. We might disagree on some of the nuances of that, but clearly within the Canadian mosaic, healthcare matters significantly. And as Ashley said in a comment that she put on the chat, we are talking essentially about caring people. And despite all of the challenges, we are engaged when we're engaging with healthcare with caring people. And I'd like to thank Ross and Ashley both for having attended to us today. We're coming back to this again next week, I believe, Tanya. And there'll be some other challenges that we're going to be addressing. But we've delved into healthcare in a way that I think is part of a national debate and should continue to be part of a national debate. Regrettably, I look around and I see more and more white hair all the time. See Warren and John and Dave Josephi and me, of course, not the rest of you. Healthcare matters to us, and healthcare matters to you as well. And so I thank you for attending. And at this point, Tanya is going to do some announcements. They're good announcements. And if you want to know what's going on in the community, please stay behind and listen to Tanya as she gives us our weekly update. Tanya.
There is a free author reading. Who is it? C.E. Hoffman. What is it? An in-person reading. Where? At Silent Sounds, 46 Essex Street, on March 29th at 7 p.m. There is a council planning meeting on Tuesday, the 21st of March at 6:30 p.m. On the agenda, the Ontario Reformatory Heritage Conservation District Study. We're looking at phase one of the report. Please have your say about community engagement, Race to Zero, and private tree protection. There will be information sessions, and there's a survey that is to be completed by April 14th. Please Google Have Your Say Guelph to get to that website. Next week on Breezy Breakfast, we will be talking again about healthcare in Ontario, and our guest is Melissa Skinner, who is the Vice President of Patient Services and the Chief Nursing Executive of Guelph General Hospital.
The healthcare crisis is worldwide, and the challenge is to find both global and local solutions. At Breezy Breakfast, we encourage frank and open discussions with our guests who share their expertise. We hope that our discussion provokes thoughtful engagements on an issue that affects us all. Music was provided by Jules Germ, and I'm Longfei Chen, and I use my expertise to produce this podcast. See you next week.